Next case.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Andrew Harding, counsel for the appellant, Gary Vasquez. At this time, I request 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
Mr. Vasquez was sentenced to 133 years for offenses committed at the age of 16. In the year 2056, he will have the opportunity to seek geriatric parole. The question is whether that's a realistic opportunity.
First question is whether or not Graham even applies to aggregating term in sentences. Graham certainly did not address the question.
It did not address the question directly. It talked about Graham. Of course, the facts were the state of Florida sentenced him to life. But the holding in Graham talked about the realistic opportunity to obtain release post-conviction. And I will admit up front.
That was the rationale of Graham. The holding was that a life sentence under those conditions. Separating the holding from the rationale is important for purposes of stare decisis.
I would say it does not address it directly, but again, the key language, the language that has been looked at nationwide by numerous courts of final jurisdiction, talks about realistic opportunity. And I will admit that nationwide, we have cases all over the book that are listed in the Commonwealth's brief. But I would note that the trend has been in the past several years towards more and more courts of final jurisdiction adopting the rationale that de facto life is life under Florida versus Graham.
But we're not a court of final jurisdiction. We're interpreting the federal constitution. The Supreme Court is the court of final jurisdiction for federal questions on cert from state Supreme Courts. And you're asking us to extend Graham, not to apply it. Why isn't that the prerogative of the court in Washington?
Because this court, of course, can interpret the Eighth Amendment as particular to Virginia law, just as much as the Florida Supreme Court could interpret the Eighth Amendment as particular to Eighth Amendment law, unless and until the U.S. Supreme Court does so. In fact, the state Supreme Court, has far greater prerogative than, for example, federal courts of appeals. Federal courts of appeals, as the Supreme Court has reminded them numerous times, cannot, in effect, extend the rationale beyond that. That's why, for example, Blakely versus Washington required a federal case to apply Blakely to federal sentencing guidelines. This court has that greater opportunity than federal courts of appeals to take the holding from one U.S. Supreme Court case and apply it to the particular instances, far greater than a federal appellate court can in a similar circumstance. But as noted in the and again, the trend nationwide as years have progressed.
So we have more power to extend U.S. Supreme Court precedent than federal courts of appeals.
Absolutely.
And we should exercise that power. That's the kind of active judicial role you want us to take.
It depends what you mean by active. You know, it is the prerogative of this court to apply U.S. Supreme Court cases to not any narrow issue. It does it all the time in Fourth Amendment cases because, frankly, the U.S. Supreme Court can only handle so many cases year in, year out. We are, in effect, the workhorse, as it were, in criminal law as to taking those rationales and applying it to particular facts, especially the Court of Appeals. I mean, the Court of Appeals interprets federal U.S. Supreme Court cases all the time as applied to unique circumstances, for example, Terry stops. Well, that's what we're asking for in this particular case. We have a rationale from Washington. We have unique facts. So how do we apply that rationale to these particular facts? And again, this court has greater leeway in interpreting the U.S. Supreme Court than the federal courts of appeals in that regard, as Supreme Court has reminded people numerous times.
That the de facto life sentence concept can be utilized here and would, in fact, be in your favor with this case. Assume that for a moment. And assume for a moment that that in this case there was not a compliance with the spirit or the letter of Graham, right? Assume both of those things. The United States Supreme Court often leaves to the states the actual crafting of how to respond and deal with the details. And that was the case in Graham and in Miller. They said, well, leave it to the states to figure out how to interpret what we just said. But they didn't say they necessarily would leave it to the state's judiciary to do that. That's part of the problem. And I note, when you get to the end of your brief, I'm always looking for what are the parties asking for. And your conclusion is very telling. You ask that we reverse the judgment of the trial court and the Court of Appeals. And it just begs the next question, and do what?
In the content of the brief, I talked about an alternate path that the trial court could have done. They could have sentenced him to an alternate, what is colloquially called a blended sentence, that is commitment to DJJ for a period of time, and by its very nature, you have annual reviews in that regard, along with an adult sentence. And any time during each of those periodic reviews, the trial court could have said, hey, we've seen some rehabilitation. We've seen some reform. In it, coupled with the fact that 19.23, either 303 or 306, allows a trial court to amend a sentence any time before a person is committed to the Department of Corrections. Now, the problem in this particular case is, of course, my client is in the Department of Corrections. But in asking the day after this court rules, that would provide a meaningful opportunity to review post-sentencing along those lines. And if Your Honor reads the sentence, the argument at sentencing, that's exactly what I asked for, to say this should not just be the ending. This should not be the final determination. Again, because they could say, hey, you have not rehabilitated yourself. But to have periodic reviews after August 2013 to look at the rehabilitation, that is what is contemplated by Graham, and there was a basis for it in statute.
Let me ask you, do you think a blended sentence, which would have an annual review just up until age 21, followed by a lengthy adult sentence, would satisfy Graham?
I think it would move it a little closer to complying with Graham. Again, I recognize, as Chief Justice Lemons noted, that it is left to the states. But that is a review post-sentencing, which is the beginning hallmark of Florida v. Graham, which was not met in this particular set of facts. Again, the whole idea is not
just... Justice Rausch is right, that the whole premise of Graham and these other cases, beginning with Roper, was that juveniles have not fully developed. You know, the prefrontal cortex development, the judgment, and all that sort of thing. And that generally speaking, occurs after their 21st birthday. And so her question is very important. If you have something in place, as you suggested, that is not going to be dealt with until well after the whole premise of these cases has passed, haven't you then violated it as well?
I think that argument could be made, but we didn't even get to that point. You know, again,
if that's true,
yes,
then there aren't any solutions on remand. That's the problem. I mean, the court can't command that parole be reinstated in the Commonwealth. That's not within, we might want to, but we can't. And the court can't command that on remand, you have a sentence and you must impose this sentence. Now, the legislature actually has, in a number of situations, have mandatory sentences, and we abide by them because we have to. But if I agree with you on your premise in this case, and I may, I don't know what we do. I think the solution may very well be across the street in the legislature. And if that's the case, what do we do?
I think, again, I recognize the limits of judicial power. In broadly speaking, I would agree that there needs to be some changes. And there have been proposals across the street, as it were, I believe at least two different times. In fact, there's one pending. To have a series of reviews after 20 years sentence, I believe that's the number. But as to a remedy in this particular case, I agree, Your Honor, that it's sort of what can we do in this particular case? And if we are hamstrung by the statute, all we can do in this instance is say this sentence is unconstitutional and remand it back to the court to do it as it wishes. I should note, though, that by that very nature, you're looking at several months between March or April, whenever this court would decide, and a remand back to the circuit court. And hopefully, there would be some sort of legislative remedy during that time period so that the circuit court could then be guided by that a little better. I take your point, and it's frustrating, but that is the choice the Commonwealth has made in pursuing the sentence at trial and the current state of the statute. It's not Mr. Vasquez.
May I take you back to the practical problem of the de facto consecutive term and the life term? Where would we draw the line as to from which jurisdictions or which sovereigns we would start to add those sentences up? If someone has multiple sentences in one circuit versus sentences from a variety of circuits, sentences from a variety of states, federal and state time, where would we start to look to determine whether when you add it up it is a de facto life sentence?
I would admit that on a case, I've seen instances where people are sentenced in multiple locations for multiple offenses. That's a different case than this, and I don't have any hard...
Well, that's where this would take us, if we start looking at a de facto consecutive...
I don't mean to duck it, but I think that would be the next case that would be developed along those lines. I would note that Mr. Vasquez, and also by extension Mr. Valentine, are easier cases, for lack of a better description, because there is no doubt that Darian Vasquez will die before he's age 132. So yes, there might be that what-if question at age 50, but those are cases where the trial court can make findings of fact as to what is life and make those decisions at that next case. But in this particular case, he's going to die in prison.
I don't see how we can decide this case without also laying down the markers that have to be abided by in the next case.
That wasn't my question. In addition to what Justice Smith just said, it's not whether he got 50 years versus 100 years in this case. It's what if he gets 10 years in this case and 10 years in the next case, and such that it adds up to 150 years.
In a single offense as this case, or two different offenses?
Different offenses, different jurisdictions. That's the practical problem that this would lead us to.
And I don't have as good of an answer because I've seen those cases. It's less well established nationwide on those questions because those are less unique than the scenario that has happened in this particular, where there's one offense, one sentence, and a pretty high sentence in that regard.
It was more than one offense. There was one sentencing event.
I apologize. One offense date, for lack of a description.
I've had the situation as a trial judge where I don't have to worry about stacking from other cases or other jurisdictions, but within the case I have before me sentencing, I'm faced with mandatory minimums, 25 years, 25 years, 25 years. Mm-hmm. Same incident, really, for usually various sex offenses. They have to be run consecutive. You have to have, if you're not giving a life sentence, you have to have 40-year suspended sentence. So someone is, if I'm just doing the minimum of following the law, someone leaves my courtroom with a 75-year sentence plus 120-year suspended sentence for the rest of his life. So if we agreed with you, the sentencing judges are still going to be faced with mandatory minimums, which I think goes to the Chief Justice's concern that this is almost beyond the judiciary to fix.
I wish I had an answer, but that's sort of the straits that we are put in place by the sentence the Commonwealth asked for, and I would ask to reserve the rest of rebuttal.
Minute 33.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court, Stuart Raphael for the Commonwealth. The Court of Appeals both correctly decided the Angel question and correctly found the evidence sufficient to support the armed burglary convictions. I'd like to start with the defects in the assignment of error with regard to the Angel claim. The assignment, as we laid out in our brief, is defective in multiple ways. It doesn't argue that Virginia's geriatric release statute, as applied, violates Graham. It misstates the legal standard, substituting meaningful probability of release for the operative requirement, which is meaningful opportunity for release. And it doesn't ask the court to overrule Angel. Graham doesn't require a meaningful probability of release, only that the state provide a mechanism to a meaningful possibility of release within the defendant's lifetime based on demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation.
Isn't the main point that Graham doesn't require anything with respect to aggregating term sentences, as the Fifth and the Sixth Circuit have held?
Well, and that's another problem with the assignment. That's correct. And we agree, the Commonwealth agrees with the comments that have been made.
So correct me if you think I'm misstating this, we have to extend existing U.S. Supreme Court precedent beyond its present limits in our expansive capacity, evidently, as a state Supreme Court, and extend it beyond where the U.S. Supreme Court has placed it in order to arrive at any of these complexities down the road.
That's exactly right. And there are a couple ways you can avoid doing that. One is to say that to agree with us that the assignment is defective. It doesn't lay its finger on what the real issue is, which is whether Graham should be extended to aggregate sentences or whether Angel should be overruled. I mean, there's been really no discussion so far about this court's holding in Angel that Virginia's geriatric release statute does provide a meaningful possibility for release at age 60. And that was the basis for what the Court of Appeals did. I mean, the trial judge here did nothing wrong. The trial judge sentenced these two gentlemen to very relatively low years for each of the counts for which they were convicted. It's, when you aggregate them, it's a longer sentence. But to the point that has been made, the court really couldn't give guidance to the trial judge on remand based on what's been argued so far.
My only point, though, is Angel's not even implicated until you apply Graham.
That's exactly right.
And what is the Commonwealth's position as to whether Graham applies to aggregating terms of imprisonment?
What we've said in our brief is that the better argument is that it does not. It's a hard question, I think, because on the one hand you've got the principle that Graham talks about and Roper and Miller that children are different, right? And so children are different. On the other hand, in Miller, the principle that children are different didn't lead to a result that categorically excluded children from life without parole sentences for homicide offenses. So you have to ask, why is it different? Why is Miller different from Graham? And I think there are two answers. The first is that there's no national survey that supports not having life without parole sentences for homicide offenders. It's the National Survey Evolving Standards of Decency issue. The other is that homicide is different. It's the worst offense, and therefore you have a different rule in Miller. I think those same two principles apply to the aggregate sentencing question. Aggregate crimes are worse than single crimes, and so a state could very properly conclude that you ought to have a life sentence for that without parole. Similarly, you might well find from a national survey, which has not been done in this case, you might find from a national survey that states and federal courts allow effective life, de facto life sentences for aggregate sentencing. You
so
can't
they
decide
have 18 that. Felonies, including some fairly violent rape and other assaults, and 18 of them could easily be equated under that rationale to a single homicide.
That's exactly right. And so one way to decide the case would be to follow former Justice Kenan's approach in U.S. v. Cobbler in 2014, where she said, look, if an appellant is going to make an Eighth Amendment national consensus argument, you've got to give me the data to show that. And the appellants here have done nothing to put into the record data that would support the conclusion that Graham should be extended to aggregate sentencing. It's clear that Graham didn't address those questions, so you couldn't even do that without having the national survey information, and because the appellants didn't provide it to the court, you could decide it on that ground. Now, I do think that Judge O'Scanlan, in his Ninth Circuit dissent from the hearing on bank in Moore versus Biden, laid out some of the very considerations the court has mentioned. How many years is the threshold? Is Virginia right that it's 60? Do you use an objective person's life expectancy? Or what if the prisoner has a disease and is not likely to have as long a life expectancy? Is it a sliding scale based on that prisoner? What about gain time, prior offenses, minimum sentences, gain time, offenses committed while incarcerated? Does the number of crimes matter? What if it's 150 non-homicide offenses? And what about sentences from other jurisdictions? I think that the fact that there's been no national survey done, these crimes can be considered much worse than a single crime, and the fact that you've got these huge practical problems, which no court has answered, and the Appellants offer no answer either. It's very likely the Supreme Court will not go that next step and say that Graham should be extended to aggregate sentencing. So that's our position. It doesn't apply.
Mr. Raphael, you know, the dilemma is I remember well the discussion of abolishing parole in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
I'm sorry.
I remember well the discussion, the political debate, the commentary on the abolishment of parole in Virginia.
Yes.
Yoked to it was the establishment of the geriatric release, presumably because that had something to do with the easing of prison populations or perhaps even the cost of continued incarceration. So I went out on the internet, and we'll call that legal research, to find the Virginia Parole Board's form for the petitioner to identify compelling reasons for release under these circumstances. Here are the questions. Are you a military veteran with an honorable discharge? Highly unlikely if they've been convicted of an offense like this before the age of 18. Do you have a retirement or disability benefits available upon release? I don't think so. Do you have disability income? No. Social Security benefits? No. Other sources of income? No. And it goes on and on and on, and every question has to do with either medical issues or money. Graham talks about rehabilitation. There's this conundrum that somehow the geriatric release statute is joined to the question that's raised in these cases, particularly in Graham, and they're not joined.
Well, if I could unpack that a little bit, I'm not sure about the form you're talking about. If it had been offered into evidence, which it's not, we probably would have responded to it. What has been cited in the record are the regulations themselves, which were before this court in Angel. The Virginia Parole Board Administrative Procedure 1.226, which we've cited, says all factors in the parole consideration process shall apply in the determination of conditional release. Your Honor mentioned the form that referenced what are the compelling circumstances. These folks haven't argued that's an issue in this case. It has been argued in the LeBlanc case, and the magistrate judge Leonard in that case said there's nothing that would prevent an offender from arguing that his conviction as a juvenile and the time served and the rehabilitation he's undergone is a compelling circumstance. But I think it's important to unpack the two questions. One is 60 the right age? If you have parole at age 60, does that satisfy Graham? And we say it does, and you said it does in Angel. The second question is, are the regulations being applied in a constitutional way? And I would submit they are. You said so in Angel. But really that issue's not ripe until offenders are ready to be released on geriatric release, and they're not until about 2038. So there's the statistical argument being made that, well, if you look at the stats on geriatric release, there are not many people being released. When you compute the percentage of folks released based on applications from the appellant's submission in the trial court, it's about 7%. Chief Justice Roberts asked Graham's counsel at oral argument, what if parole results in the release of only 1 in 20? And the response was, that's fine. As long as there's a mechanism in place to deal with it, that would satisfy the constitutional requirement. That's 5% is lower than 7%, even if you accept their numbers. Magistrate Judge Leonard explained...
Well, their number 7%?
I
never thought it number.
The average was.
Okay.
Well, 7%, there's eligibility applications and then those granted. And Magistrate Judge Leonard also explained that the statistics are really misleading, not only because no juvenile is eligible yet for parole, but because the way the system is set up, you can either get parole or geriatric release, and it shunts people into parole, which is automatic review, geriatric release, by contrast, you've got to apply for it. So the stats are really misleading, and neither the magistrate judge in LeBlanc nor even Judge Randall Wright Allen thought the statistics were significant. But my other point is that if the parole board is not administering the regulations correctly, that's an issue that can be addressed at the time they become eligible for release, and that's not going to happen for a number of years. You don't have to decide that issue now. Alternatively, if you did think it was a problem, then what you could do, what the correct thing to do would be to have a sort of a limiting, narrowing ruling that said...
The Federal Sentencing Commission actually has documents that they use to define things. They define a life sentence as anything that is, 59, 59 No, it's 40 years.
39.5.
49.5 years 39. Or more.
39.
30, excuse me, it's 39 or more. So you take an 18-year-old and the eligibility is age 60. That's 42 years. So what you're suggesting is that those people in the sentencing business, at least in the federal government, have had a life sentence calculated at 39.4.5, but we're supposed to accept 42 years, which is in effect the completion of a life sentence, according to them, before they're even eligible to be considered for some kind of relief. How does that work? And what do we do about it?
Right. How do you square that with Graham?
Right.
Mr. Justice, I would take issue with relying on the federal sentencing guidelines. I think what you want to rely on...
It's not reliance. It's one of those sort of things where you look out there and try to make the analogy.
But I think what you ought to rely on is 8.01-419, which is the life expectancy table, which shows that a 16-year-old male is going to live to 75.6 years. I think that's what you should rely on. The other point that I think is relevant here is if you go back and look at where at the argument that was made in the circuit court, both appellants said that it would be constitutional to sentence them to 47 years. That wouldn't violate the Eighth Amendment. In this case, they're going to be eligible for release after 44 years at age 60. I think that's a real problem for their position.
Counsel, I want to follow on to Chief Justice Lemon's question. And I'm not entirely sure whether there will be a question at the end or whether this is simply the judicial version of event. But Justice Roush mentioned her prior life as a trial judge. My prior life was in the General Assembly. And I sat on the subcommittee of the Courts of Justice Committee that reviewed the Parole Commission's findings and recommendations. And let me begin also by saying I don't think Graham controls this particular case. This would require an extension beyond what Graham required. And so, you know, meaningful opportunity doesn't constitutionally come into play unless Graham is implicated. But I can remember Dr. Kern, who then chaired the Sentencing Commission here in Virginia, passed away 3 or 4 years ago. I can remember his argument about why we should eliminate parole because geriatric release was the... was such an important aspect of it. I can remember the statistics that the possibility of committing a violent crime goes way, way, way down as you pass out of your 30s into your 40s and is almost negligible by the time you reach age 60. I can remember them talking about the economic aspects of why geriatric release was important because we wouldn't have to build more prisons. Those arguments have been lost somewhere because, frankly, whether we're talking 5% release, 1% release, one of the statistics I read in the context of these two cases was less than 1% release. That's not how it was supposed to work. Now, my frustration is that I don't see how we can correct that as a court, particularly in this case. But someone who has the authority to change that needs to go back and look at it very carefully. I don't think it's us. But someone here in Richmond needs to do so.
I think.
Don't you agree?
It's always good for improving the system, absolutely. But I think the answer to your question is really threefold. The first is the possibility of meaningful release at age 60 sufficient to satisfy Graham? And we say it is.
I don't think Graham applies. I think you have to go beyond Graham to reach the facts.
The second point, Your Honor, is that. You ask whether Virginia's system provides a meaningful opportunity for release at age 60. And this was you mentioned that you thought the statistics were low. We think the statistics are misleading. The regs on their face allow the same parole considerations for geriatric release as for parole. And as we pointed out in our brief, geriatric release is defined as a form of parole in the parole regulations themselves.
All right. You're going to have another opportunity in just a moment.
I could speak briefly about the assignment of error issue. Wanted to make the court aware of one more case I came up with since the brief, and I made Mr. Raphael aware of it. Moore versus Commonwealth from 2008, 276 Virginia 747. And that was a general idea that how there was a conflation of reasonable doubt, reasonable articulable suspicion with probable cause. Everyone knew why they were there, namely a Fourth Amendment violation. Everyone knew what the issue was, the application of Graham to Virginia sentencing. Graham was cited at the trial level and on and on. That distinguishes the case from Crane versus Bristow, where it used language of instead of, that is, to the exclusion of one standard versus another. Without any further questions, I'll move on to the substance.
What was the cite on Moore?
276 Virginia 747. It's a 2008 case from this court. As to the statistics actually are at page 27 of the appellee's brief. In 2014, there were two Supreme Courts nationwide that ruled that de facto life is a concept. In 2015, there were two Supreme Courts that ruled that it was about de facto life, and one that ruled against us. The sort of fractured nature only happens in 2013 and 2012. So what we see is a trend, not a huge trend, but a trend of recognizing this nationwide. And that's what we're asking for in this particular case. As to the use of statistics, again...
May I ask you a question there? Because I asked myself, well, what's different now from when we decided Angel? I'm concerned with stare decisis. And what we have here is the data that was presented to the trial court about just how often geriatric release is granted. But I'm a little confused by the data because it says, I'm looking at Joint Appendix 35 and 36, it says we've got 3 years of information. Then it has fiscal year 2010, fiscal year 2011, fiscal year 2012, and then another fiscal year 2012. So it's 4 years of information, and two of them are labeled to fiscal year 2012, which are different numbers. So, you know, if this is our basis for looking at it again, I find it confusing and perhaps internally inconsistent.
To be blunt, ma'am, that happened at the 11th hour of getting information from parole board. I tried for 2 months and got him like 72 hours before sentencing, and that's why it happened. I'll just admit that outright.
Well, can you clarify it for me now? Is it 2013? Is that the last one?
That's probably what happened.
Okay. Yes. Thanks.
What difference does that make? Because it doesn't apply. We're not talking about juvenile cases. I mean, if you're going to have a meaningful analysis of the statistics, you ought to have juveniles who have been granted geriatric release. And you're not going to have that for another 40 years.
And that's the bind Mr. Vasquez is in. And I'm not saying that the court should adopt LeBlanc. I'm just saying the reasoning of LeBlanc goes through step by step why, we can't wait. Number one, the procedural hurdles that would happen way out when. Number two, the fact that, again, we have the statistic, and the statistics show a trend as of now. Not perfect, but show a trend of more people in DOC, and despite that. But more importantly, it begs the question, what's going to happen between now and then? In Graham, the court recognized that extensive sentencing delays imposing rehabilitation because, understandably, DOC wants to send people in rehab who are about to be released tomorrow as opposed to someone who's going to be released in 133 years. So, I'm sorry, am I over time?
Yeah, I think you've answered the question as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. For the sake of those who are spectators, there's a co-defendant in this case, and the co-defendant's case will now be heard. Call the next case. Well.